This is Liz Chappell with Bill Oates and Graham Wilson at Byron Station, speaking with Bill Swan and Christine Swan on the 14th of June, 2017. So I suppose the best place for us to start is at the beginning. Now, it wasn't the Swans who first settled at Byron, was it? Your family came a little later?
My family came quite a bit later. The first settlement was the McIntyre family. Who were in the Hunter Valley. They came into this area because the initiative that the McIntyres showed to Cunningham when he came over the mountain ranges saved him virtually weeks of travel when he came north, going up into the Darling Downs area. So he saved him a lot of time showing his stock and showing the track over. So Cunningham forged ahead, picked up a month because of the McIntyres, and then probably most people realised the route that Cunningham took, which is he crossed the Guide around about the Bingra area, went right through west of Inverell, but not a long way west of Inverell, through to Yetman, up into the Darling Downs, and then back, very close to the same track on the way back. But he did meet up with Peter McIntyre, again in the Hunter Valley on his property down there, and told him about this country. And he said, if I was you, I'd head up there and select some country, and I'll tell you where there is a good block. I mean, this is paraphrasing it, I suppose, but it just gives you a bit of a rough idea.
We're talking about 1838 at this point?
1836, I think it would have been, 1836, because Byron was actually selected, according to government gazette and records, in 1837 as a settlement in the name of McIntyre. Byron, according to what we're told, as I say, I'm no expert, that was the date it was settled, where historians have looked up records. The first settlement was 2 miles either side of the McIntyre River, running from approximately Brodie's Plains to Bacala. And that was the first registered area settled. And it was stories about why was it called Byron. Byron the poet was probably well known in that period. But my father said it wasn't Byron the poet. There was a fellow called Peter Byron, in charge of the horses with Cunningham.
Oh.
And he anyway, when he was just west of Byron, one night the horses got away. So he headed out and tracked them down, and he tracked them down and found them on the river, on what is now known as the McIntyre River, at Byron, as it is today. And so that's how Byron is supposed to have got its name. Now, whether that's right or not, the only thing that substantiate that's a little bit, that Peter Byron's family did settle or lived in the Gyra area, and there's records of that. So that family stayed in the northwest. But so Peter Byron, according to Dad, that's how Byron got its name. And so the McIntyres, after Cunningham gave them the story, came up and took up that parcel of land.
And then the Swans, did you tell me it was about 1920?
Then? No, 1900, but after that there were McIntyres, and Byron was owned by different people without sort of looking up until it was owned, the major owner, I suppose, and a close in the 1890s was George Cruikshank.
Mm-hmm.
Now, George Cruikshank was a local member, had no family, but he, no children, married no children. But he had sisters and one thing or another. And he lived at Byron. He did have country, I think, in that Forbes area too. But he was a local member, very involved in many things in the district. There's a plaque in the Inverell District Hospital. Well, he was the main person who pushed to get the first hospital in the town. He was involved in other things. There's the Byron Arcade, for instance, that's in Inverell and has recently been restored. He built that It was built in 1904. The Inverell Club, before the Inverell Club, was built on the site where it is at the moment, and it was built as a club, one of the few buildings in Australia, I think, that was built as a club. A lot of old buildings have been formed into clubs, but he financed the first club that wasn't on that site, but he was financed the building of the first men's club in Inverell. He died, and the estate was then sold, and it was called the Byron Estate at that stage, and that was in 1906.
Mm-hmm.
And there are quite a few details. I've got the original advertisement of all the blocks, how many blocks there were and where they were, and the Historical Society have researched and found who bought blocks. My grandfather bought the homestead block plus two or three other blocks. They're generally fairly small blocks, but there were something like 130 or 40 blocks altogether. So that was the estate Byron was sold up. It's a wonderful ad where you got terms to buy the land and records of what was produced off the land and the dairy farms, the yields of crops, and anyway, I can show you that.
Yes, no doubt Bill and Graham will get a copy of that.
I'm sure they will. I'm sure they will. So that's, and my grandfather bought the homestead block, and he, without going to his, he came from Ashford, the Ashford area. He was at a place called Fraser's Creek.
Mm-hmm.
Shall I tell you anything about that, or is that?
Oh, yes, by all means. We've got plenty of time.
They went broke in Victoria. They settled in Coleraine in the 1860s, and like many of them in that area, and then the family dispersed, and his side of the family came north to Inverell District with uncles, a couple of uncles that came with him. They were Fletchers, and there are still Fletchers about the New England even today. And they settled at Fraser's Creek. And in the 1902 drought, hard times for everyone on the land. And he, as the story goes, owed a local stock and station agent quite a lot of money, I suppose. But he sold his share, his half share of Fraser's Creek to the stock and station agent, whose name was John Sinclair, the father of the famous Sinclair brothers. And then from that he bought Byron, and that's the best move he ever made in his life, I'd say, when he bought Byron. So that's how we were established in 1906. And from there, well, we're still here.
Now, the homestead was, of course, or the earliest part of the homestead was here before then?
That's right. That was built and added to by the Cruikshank family in the 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but prior to that, it was built, according to the National Trust, it appears as if it was built not a long while after they settled, not just here, but on the flat, not far from here. It's only a kilometre down to where the original huts and things were.
Mm-hmm.
And then they built this house. National Trust, from what they research they can find, and it's pretty hard to get really good records of it, but they say 1840s.
Now, can you describe for the tape what the original part of the house looks like? Is it the part that we're sitting in now?
Yes, it is. It's the centre part of the house, which is basically the same as when it was built, and we have photos taken in 1890 showing the front of the house, so you can see. Then when my grandfather bought it, he made probably the major alteration he made was the fact that he put a bay window into the main bedroom of the house, which was probably a lounge room then,
mm-hmm.
and added a wing on another section, which is that section we're looking at now, And it was, that room there, which is a bedroom now, was the classroom. It was used as a schoolroom. It's got a special floor in it, so the kids played in there. So that was an addition. Since then the Cruikshanks added what's called the billiard room,
mm-hmm.
on the southern side of the main building. And then Christine and I added, the billiard room was a very dark room and had a big bay window one end, and it was starting to fall down and fall out. So instead of just pulling that down and putting it, we added a section onto that, so that opened up that whole area, which we call lounge room, dining room, billiard room now, sort of put together, with a bathroom, another veranda that gave the bedroom down that end of the house, instead of walking 100 yards from one end of the house to the other to get to the bathroom. And that opened that up in a big way, so you could sort of, plenty of light, where it was hardly ever used when we were kids. It was always shut up, it was just too dark. Even to the, when our kids were young, there were two young lasses used to babysit out here. But they were never game to go into that room if we left them here at night. And the doors were always closed and they sat by the fires, other parts of the house. And they said to us one day, years later, we thought you might have had an old auntie that lived out there and we weren't going to disturb her. But that's how quiet it was. But when we added to it so the doors matched all the original doors, the windows matched the original windows. And so it looks part. Unless you looked, you saw the photos that were taken in the 1890s and you see a photo taken now, or even in 1906, you can see the extension.
Now, all of the house, of course, is in weatherboard. Was that timber from the property, at least in the early
stages? Don't know. Really don't know that for sure. The only part that's brick is the billiard room that was added to in 1890 mm-hmm. by the Cruikshanks.
And the chimneys.
Well, the chimneys, well, they were part of the original, so I suppose the bricks and things in the chimneys were the original bricks that were made on the place. And all the timber's all pitsawn timber, obviously, the old homemade nails that you can see in the timber now. Shingles on the roof, and the shingles are still there, underneath the iron.
Yes.
The iron's been replaced and the shingles are still underneath that, which was a study in itself when they... We've taken photos of, they took the tin off and then looked at the structure. I've forgotten now, but it's written down. I wanted to find out how many shingles went to every square metre of roof.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. I mean, the overlap was about 75% of every shingle. See, to make
really?
And the number of shingles that came off the roof, and some we on one section that we didn't put them back on because of different reasons. But I kept all the shingles and gave them to the village, the Pioneer Village, so they could use them in there. But to be quite honest, I'm not sure whether they ever used them or they wood chipped or whatever. But they
so
quite
be
a lot.
Ironbark shingles.
That evidently, no, they say they're ironbark, but there was a timber here that, in the original yards, that are in the 1890 photo, and they're old yards then. And I said, there must be iron bark. And one old fellow that was out here said, there was a timber that grew all around. It was a type of gum, but the red gum timber these days is considered pretty ordinary timber for buildings. But those, we've still got I've kept all the timber that you could keep out of those yards.
Mm.
And apart from the narrow bits that have been mortised into the uprights, it's as solid as the day they were put up there. But he said, no, they're not ironbark, there's something else. And I was a bit of a kid when he told me. This fellow that turned up here one day, he is well into his 80s, Darby, and I'll tell you his name later on, it just escapes me. But his father and his name written on one of the photos in there was the manager here at the time. And he had so many stories that he could tell us about the bird life, the dingoes. You mentioned dingoes and how story about how they chased the dingoes home and how they used to pull the stirrup iron off and chase the dingo down and swing the stirrup iron on the end of their leather. And just stories. He could remember the bird life, the plovers and the things that used to run about the sandy pits and things. And
so you're talking beginning of the 20th century?
Heath was his name, Darby Heath.
Yes.
Yep.
And that's the same period as you have those wonderful old photographs.
That's right. That's right. With the names on the back of them that the Cruikshank family sent out to us. There was a Hargraves in it and different ones like that. But he, you know, what those old fellows could remember and tell you about, the yards, he could tell us about the yards. There were two cottages side by side that shared a chimney, but different family lived in one and one lived in the other. The yards, and he said, and that's that yard over there, he said, was the anti yards. That's where the stallions were. And it had very high timber walls around it. And I said, stallions must have been hard to handle. And would they get out? And he said, oh, no, young Bill. You couldn't have the ladies seeing a stallion serving the mares. So you had to have the high walls so they couldn't be seen. Little stories like
fantastic.
That. Even what happened in towns, in the town. He'd say, go to town on Saturday. You'd meet up with your friends and one thing or another, and the ladies would go to town on Saturday and they'd walk the streets in their finery and talk, and then at about 4 o'clock, they'd all disappear and go to houses for their tea. And he said, all the men would meet on the riverbank where the town is at the moment. And it was a, you know, very main crossing where they came from New South Wales into Queensland, and that's where they crossed. And I said, what did you do, drink grog? He said, oh, very little, very little. He said, we did two things. He said, we recited a lot of poetry and we boxed. He said, we always had a boxing ring up.
Yeah.
And so you could box or you could recite poetry. I said, how would you get two things so different?
But the poetry comes as a surprise.
Well, it is.
For Bushmen, yeah.
And I said, what did you do? And he said, I did both. And he said, and I've still got poems that I wrote and recited, which he gave me, which I've still got, of course.
Were they British poems or Australian?
No, it's poems he's written
himself,
particularly about. I mean, one about where his brother went off to war, in the First World War, and he described how he went off and his mother waved him goodbye, and how he used to box and wear the lawn bare where they boxed.
Yes.
Little things like that. And, you know, about the animals. And no, they're all just plain, good story poems.
Isn't that amazing?
And, you know, I've got those out there. You can tell I've forgotten a lot. And he was, anyway, he lived in Sydney, but we tried to keep in touch with him. But a young fellow doing architecture at the university, decided he wanted to research Byron. So fortunately, I was able to give, I think it was Punchbowl where this fellow lived, and they met up. And from that, he drew plans of the old home.
Oh, wonderful.
And that he could tell him. I mean, I can remember quite a lot of it, but it's a bit like telling people where the tennis court, the old brick tennis court is. And people wouldn't accept that was a tennis court. But I had a photo here, fortunately, that was taken in the 1890s, where there are two ladies standing on the court in their finery with their tennis rackets in their hands.
So it was the Cruikshanks that put the brick tennis court in?
I think it would have had to be the Cruikshanks, yeah. Mm-hmm. The people before, there was a McGregor, I think, I'd have to sort of go back and couple of other families that sort of had it for a small time. So as the country changed hands a bit there, because Bannockburn Station, which is a well-known part of this, was part of Byron too at one stage. And Byron, the original settlement, I'm told that the places that joined Byron were Mile Creek, Gunnee, and then there was Byron, and then there was King's Plains. And they sort of met together, and then Bacala on the northern side of it, and they were all part of those sort of the original ones. Today, Inverell Station comes down onto our boundary now, but Inverell Station really never came onto the river. They went up the Swan Brook and they selected country up there.
Right. Were they originally taken up at about the same time as Byron, or were they actually taken off the original Byron?
No, it was the original Byron, but it was only in a narrow bit where it came down to the Swan Brook. And it was gazetted, I think, in... no, can be corrected on this, but you just... As close as I'm told, and research people... It was gazetted and taken up by Peter Campbell in 1845 or 1846. So it was about 10 years after Byron. And he came into the area. He came with the Campbell and Boddy story is a wonderful story too, and the family and how they settled. And not many people owned country. In one family owned country as long as they owned country, and that's Inverell Station. And the Campbells married Boddies, who were Strathbogian. And Ginderbine, where they came from, the Boddies came from Ginderbine. But Campbell was sent up here with men to manage Byron, and that was his job. But like any fellow that's going to get ahead, he progressively developed country for himself, which is why Evenly runs up the Swan Brook rather than around the river, which was already spoken for by the McIntyres. And that was probably 9 or 10 years from what I'm told after McIntyre originally settled here. So Campbell managed Byron until he was substantial and went on and developed his own country.
For the sake of the record, could you describe the country a little bit as it is now, the soil type and the climate?
Well, Byron itself was, 72,000 acres or whatever it was when it was subdivided, but that's shown more clearly and accurately on the advertisement for the place. At the moment, Byron is just under 1,800 acres, if I can speak acres. It's virtually all basalt. 80% of it is probably river flats, alluvial river flats. There's a little bit of lighter country on it where the old woolshed was established. So that's what it was, and that's when I've added to it by buying a couple of small farms around. It was probably only about 1,100 acres of it left in my father's time, and we've added to that, but we've added country that was part of Byron. I bought 3,000 acres that virtually adjoins Byron, which is west of Byron, runs up the Rob Roy Gully. Apart from getting away from Byron, Paradise and Dera and Carinya.
So you and your sister grew up here, was that's correct?
Yep.
And you didn't have the school here in the schoolroom at the house at that
no,
stage?
No. Actually, during the war, we lived here as kids, and then when Dad went away... we moved into a cottage in town when we went to school from a cottage in town. And this place was virtually looked after by Archie Sinclair. How he managed to do that with all the country the Sinclair brothers owned, and Waterloo, Collymungle, Bull Carroll, Ardersea. They were the biggest. Just as a side, when John Sinclair bought my grandfather out of Fraser's Creek, that's where they started. And they went from that to being the biggest old terms PP board ratepayers in New South Wales.
Wow,
that's how big
really?
They were. And that's how much country they owned. And so that was virtually in two generations. That's from there were four brothers,
mm-hmm.
Archie Sinclair, Sir Colin Sinclair, Jack Sinclair, and Duncan Sinclair. They all married, but only Jack Sinclair was the only one that had any children, and he had a son and a daughter, Ian and Pam.
That's Ian, who was our MP for so long.
No relation.
Oh, no relation. No connection.
Ian lived at Waterloo.
Mm-hmm.
They owned Waterloo too. And then they went from that within the next two generations. And come about from developing very quickly. But I wouldn't even say that. But I would say the basic reason for the demise was that only one of them had children, and probate. Probate wiped them out.
As it did a lot of old families.
You paid probate on thousands of acres, and then the next brother died and you did it again.
Yes, and if you had deaths in close sequence.
Yeah. And AMLNF were one of the major financiers of it, and they took over properties. And what they did and how the stories associated with the Sinclairs. I've got so many. Archie Sinclair, who married Dad's sister, Isabel. Archie and Dad were very, very close friends, to the extent that I think they spoke to each other every night when Dad mm-hmm. was at home after the war. And Archie was an extraordinary man, just a very, very large man. And obviously a very, very wealthy man, but a very generous man, and a very funny man, very funny man. But he liked to grog, and there are so many stories that I won't record. But they are so interesting, so interesting to hear what he did and how people treated him. And one I can relate reflects very well on him. A fella, when Gunny, it was sold, parts of it were sold, and a near neighbour, Archie put in a boundary gate, and this fella objected to the boundary gate being put in between the two places, so he challenged Archie challenged him about why he put a gate in there without saying, just because you're a Sinclair and one thing, don't think you can come around here. And Archie said to him, got any firewood on your place? And he said, no, it's all been knocked down, one thing or another. And Archie said, well, there's plenty in that back paddy joining you on Gunnee. He said, I put the gate in there, you're welcome to it.
It's a perfect solution, isn't it?
Yeah, well, those are the sort of things that you remember and think about what he did.
Can you take me back to growing up here with your sister?
Yep.
You came back after the war. Yep. You were still primary school age
then? Yeah, still we started school when we were living in town and went to Ross Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And then came back here, but we still went to town. And we used to ride our bikes from here to the Ashford Road, mm-hmm. which is only 3 kilometres, or a bit further than that. Used to ride over there, and then we'd catch the bus. Put our bikes under the trees there and then catch the bus to town and go to school. And then we'd walk from the school down to get the bus home. The bus didn't drop you, always drop you at the school. You'd probably drop you at what is called the old Central Hotel. That was sort of the bus stop, and then you walked up the hill and went to school, and then after school you walked down over the bridge, or the goat track then, which was a shortcut, waited there till they got all the, it was a public bus, and you got the heavy drinkers out of the bar and all shared the bus on the excuse me, and the bus was operated by a family that had been in the district for many years before, the Coggan, Jimmy Cogan. Jimmy, he was the bus driver in those days, from Ashford, and they'd drive all the way to Ashford and then back up again the next day. And so we went to school there, and then we were at home, so the while we went to school in town, you didn't, there was no organised sport on the weekends. It just didn't happen in those days, so you didn't take part in anything particular, but we always had our horses, and we swam a lot, and I had a little skiffy sort of a boat that I could put in the river, which I spent a lot of time in the river, we all did. You could push it into the banks, and your dogs would hop on the front, and away you'd go, and then you pull into a bank and they'd jump. So that's the, and we played tennis.
On the brick court?
No, by that stage, this other court, the front of the house, the brick court, being just made out of bricks, had become, you got a fairly irregular bounce out there, and my mother soon fixed that by, as soon as that court, and she was a very keen and a very good tennis player, and she soon had some trees growing on the old tennis court. So we played a lot of tennis, and then as we grew up, in the weekends, our entertainment as kids was going to other places. This weekend, everyone would come and play tennis here, the neighbours from around about. The following weekends, they'd go to Burma or to McIntyre Park or whatever the other Marilma. And so we played with all the other kids and did our own things. And Inverell Station was another one, when it was managed by Jack McColl in those days, and his wife, Margaret McColl, who was a very good tennis player. So that was Sunday. Sunday entertainment for the parents and the kids, of course, because there's always something different than another property, whether it's a creek, tadpoles or bird traps or whatever.
Now, it's probably a foolish question to ask a teenage boy's impression of the garden, but do you have any recall of the garden around Byron when you were a youngster here?
Yes, it's enlarged, of course, and the trees have grown, but my mother was a very keen gardener, but there was the water supply to the garden was windmill from the river, so erratic, to say the least. And a good job it was, because it was a push-bar job. And, you know, I think of the things she did. I mean, she used to roll the court if she had to. Big old concrete roller, and she'd push the mower. And then I can remember coming home.
When you say a push mower, just for the record, one of those little cylinder mowers?
Yeah, it's only about a foot wide.
Yes.
Pushed, rocked it backwards and forwards as the blades chopped. And
how large an area was she mowing with that mower?
Oh, there's probably, it wouldn't be a big area, but a big area if you had to push a mower over. And then I can remember coming home one day, and Dad had bought, we were taking out the front, a motor mower, Atco was the model, where you started up a petrol engine and put her into gear and away you went. So that changed, all of a sudden, the Victor's recorded as being changed, turned grass into lawn, I think was the expression used, excuse me, and so that made a difference to the mowing of the lawns and one thing or another. And as I'm not a hoarder, but I'm not good at selling old things. And I've still got that Atco mower in the shed.
Now, the spelling A-T-C-O?
A-C-T-O.
Thank you. It's probably one of the very ones of few in captivity still.
Probably is, and I'm sure it's still out there. Which leads me back to something else. When we were kids here, there was no power. There was only kerosene lights. Kerosene fridge, and that the kerosene lamps are the old ones with the globe light on them.
Mm-hmm.
Heating, hot water heating came from the kitchen stove, and the laundry had the concrete tubs and the hopper. The ironing was done with the irons just out on the stove.
The Mrs. Potts.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. You had a handle that clicked into them, and I've still got those. And then Dad put in the 32-volt lighting plant. I'm feeling ashamed to say that that's in a shed out there, and the old motor and the board and everything, the batteries have all gone, but that's still out in the shed. But I should go back a little bit further. What was here prior to the war,
mm-hmm.
and when my grandparents were here, they had a gas lighting system.
What?
Which, so there was gas piped through the house, and they had the little gas lights.
That would have been very innovative.
Well, it was, I think, and it was run with carbide gas,
mm-hmm.
and the carbide gas, you need someone to explain this to you, but the carbide gas was where you drop water onto carbide that turned into gas that was pushed through the house, and what turned the carbide plant were these. You had to have a tower, and you wound these weights up the tower, and they slowly came down and drove them down. Again, I'll say the original carbide gas producer is still here.
Really?
But it's never been put in a shed. The basic outside part of it is still there. And I do know, I tried to research it a bit, and the only person this is going back a lot of years, because I can go back a fair few years now, unfortunately, but Forbes, Robertson Cunningham?
Yes, indeed.
They had one of these, and I went and asked him about it,
right.
And there was one, and whether it's still there or not, was at Cay Buffet, that's owned by the skippers now.
Oh, well, the old house at Cay Buffet
burnt down. So
yeah.
It's probably gone, but I saw... Went and met with Forbes one day to see if I could find out a bit how it all worked and one thing. I did find out a little bit, but I'm not mechanically minded and really, but I can remember because we climbed the tower and you wound the weights up and we were threatened not to touch it. And basically that's what it did. You wound the weights up and slowly came down with all the pulleys and one thing and another turned that produced the gas.
We'll have a look at that later.
Well, I hope we can see it because of the trees growing around it.
Now, speaking of the trees, was it your grandmother who planted these trees, or do you think they were here earlier?
Well, a lot of them were here, not the ones you see now apart from the old pepper tree
mm-hmm.
at the back, which was here and is in an old, one of the old photos. But most of the trees, Christine would be better at telling you this, but the original photos taken in the 1890s had the pine trees, and there were three big pine trees along the front of the house, just outside of the hedge there, and one here, just beside the house.
Right.
Which is...
Now, radiata pines were...
No, a lot bigger pines, whatever they called, but you have to ask the expert about that.
Right.
You had to cut that one down close to the house, and it was a real threat. If it blew over, it would wipe out the wing of the house. We cut that down, and where we're sitting now, on the veranda, I think you'd say is attractive, it's good in the sun, and we spend a lot of time here. Before, when that tree was there, of course, you got none of this because it was all shade.
You wouldn't get all your lovely morning sun. You
don't get any of that, so we gauzed this veranda, and it's a place at this time of the year where you just, if anyone wants to build a house in this area, they want to come out here with a compass and find out which way this house is set, because without a doubt it's absolutely the right angle to get the sun at the right time. 9:30 in the morning in the middle of winter, you're protected from anything from the south to the west, and you've got the sun. So basically, the bones of the garden she put together. Was interesting, as Christine said, she used to persevere with plants, and and Christine's very good too, and she understands all that, where I don't.
We'll have a good garden yarn later on.
I think
on.
That's the thing to do.
Yes. Now, the layout, I think Christine said to me the driveway used to come a different direction.
It did. The driveway came in so you could drive to the front of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'll point out the gate to you. That's basically where the gate is. But the garden extends well before that. You drove up the drive as it goes past the front of the house, did a loop around and then back out. And it was the drive then, because I've got a photo of my grandparents sitting in a new Austin car at the front steps of the house where they drove in. Someone must have driven it in, because when you bought a car in those days, whenever it was, 1907 or whatever, part of the deal if you bought a new car was they taught you to drive it. So John Swan went to town, learnt to drive the car, made the arrangements to drive it back home again. So everyone on Byron that was about went up to the main road where he turned in through the gate, past the county yards to come down to the house. To get that far, you had to drive across the river twice, one at the Red Rock Crossing, as we call it today, the back of the cemetery, and the next one, the Byron Crossing, which is adjacent. Mm-hmm. Anyway, everyone was waiting for him to come up. The gate's open for him to swing in through the gate, and he missed the gate by about four panel of fences. Cleaned up all the fence and one thing and another. Everyone cheered and one thing. And he never drove again. He'd sooner get in the horse and buggy and drive to town than drive a car. So that's an offside of how you feel when you get old and you're not mechanical. But he, cars and...
So that was your grandfather.
That was my grandfather, John Swan.
Your father would have grown up here as well?
He grew up here, and he did go away to school, but only for a bit over a year, and probably nearly 2 years, and then couldn't afford to send him again, so he went to Scots in Sydney. And finished up there in, I think it's about 1920, and which gives a long association with Scots. Cause
that's where you went as well?
I went there, Ben went there, his three sons have gone there and are still there, one of them's still there. All Ben's sons have finished. Our daughter's got a son there and another son to come. And our other daughter has got two younger ones that may go to Scots, may not, but that's to be decided. So by the time Susanna's son leaves Scots, we would have had an association with Scots for at least 100 years.
Isn't that remarkable?
Which is pretty...
Very, very few families could claim that.
No, well, they can't at Scots, because we know I went to a... where you put down what grandchildren you had at Scots. And at the time we had four there, but the main speaker on the day was introduced with having more grandsons there than anyone else. Mm. So he was the main speaker, and he was very good, very interesting. The only thing that was wrong, we had four there at the same time, so not that that mattered, but, and they were there for... So that's the association. And the other thing, going back that far, I've got an old hat band here that was given to me by my uncle Archie Sinclair, because he went there. It was one of the original hat bands. And there's a photo, and we took a long time to track it down, the date, but it was the original hat band. And there's a photo of the Scots prefix in 1910. And they've got their boaters, because we all wore boaters then. You can see the original headband.
How remarkable.
I've offered it to Scots. Mm-hmm. No one's very interested, so I didn't give it to them. I still got it here.
One of your grandsons will be a worthy recipient?
Well, someone should. I mean, if it's the only one in existence, Every chance it is. Scots have been going for, I think they're celebrating 125 years next year.
So that's a little bit longer than Taz. I think Taz was, what, 1895 in Armidale?
Yeah, very close to at the same time. I mean, King's has been going longer. And but anyway, that's when they settled at the Bellevue Hill. But no one was terribly interested. And if they're not terribly interested, I don't want to be a nuisance.
So after school, after Scots, you came back here to the farm with your parents?
I came back. I couldn't get back here quick enough. And I came back and I stayed for 12 months. And my father, when he came back from... My father was a wonderful stockman. Placid, old Bill. You know, he was so well-liked and such even temperate and everything else, but... Dad and I didn't get on terribly well because I was probably temperament wise I probably took after my mother, and so I wanted to do things and Dad didn't, and so it wasn't going to work. So I got a chance. I was offered a job at Hazeldene. With the Litchfields?
Yes.
So I couldn't get down there
with the fine wool?
Well, not so much fine wool. They were always a broader type wool, but a very old. They celebrated their 165 years there about two or three years ago at a dinner, which was, got an invitation to go there, which was just so good. I loved Hazeldene. I loved the people that were there, the jackaroos, everything associated with it. It was just, and the learning. I mean, they did so much research for the wool industry, for the cattle industry, and you were part of all that. The weighing of fleeces, the measuring of the bulls, the types of wool. They were just, and they haven't existed as a family and still do exist after 165 years. Anyway, I went in and I was very privileged to be the guest speaker.
Oh, at their reunion dinner?
So,
yeah.
So many things you can recall that happened to you there. And people were so interested. It brought back memories, which is probably why I'm talking to you now. You know, people listen to that and say, oh, I remember when we did this, And there were a couple of sad things. One of the fellows I was jackarooed with when he was killed soon afterwards when he was left, but he'd only just married and it turned out his wife was pregnant, so she had a son.
So we're talking 1950s?
Yeah, 1950, late 1950s. And one of the things as a result of me speaking at that time, I got a letter from the son.
Oh, the son whose father was killed.
Oh,
that's special.
Which I could pass on some things to him. He was living, had a restaurant in London. Word got back to him and got a terrific
job. Oh, that's special.
So those sort of things make history worthwhile, stories, because you can talk about them very generally. Yeah.
Oh, that is a special experience.
Was.
And then you came back here and met
Christine? I came back here. I wanted to stay longer. And I had a job there that, I was suiting me and was suiting them. But circumstances arose where I had to come home, which I did. And Dad wasn't very well then, and anyway, so we... I came back to Byron.
And so you were living here at the homestead at
living
that point?
In a cottage, no. Yeah, when we came home, I came home, and then some years later, I'm not too good on years, but then Christine and I married. But I was living in the house with Mum and Dad. Dad was in hospital a lot of the time. And then we lived in there was an old bag cottage It's still there at the moment, so I got to work and sort of renovated that and made a house
now
livable.
Buy a bag cottage.
Well, all that was in the cottage was there was no bathroom, kitchen, anything like that. It was just in those days there was no bulk handling of grain, everything was in bags, and that was where we kept all the bags.
Oh, right, yes.
So anyway, I set to work and over a period did all the things that you got to do if you're going to bring a new bride in, like digging a septic tank and did all the plumbing and painted it all and lined places that weren't lined, and then got a builder out to do up and put two rooms together and make a kitchen.
Mm-hmm. And that was up towards the cattle yard.
That's at the back of the cattle yard, and that's still there now, and I've always kept it. It's rented.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been someone living in it, which is important, no matter how, as long as I look after it. And we've had some few young people there who've gone on to marry and then go on to the next one, and then, you know, a good friend of mine married and had nowhere to go, so that was his wedding present.
Yes.
12 months in
the
cottage.
We
called it Sid's Cottage because there's an old pensioner lived in it before we moved into it. And it was pretty rough, I'll admit it. And Sid Ponder was his name. He used to do a bit of gardening here and he lived in the cottage.
I was going to ask you that, whether your mother had help with the garden.
Yes, he used to come down once or twice in great old Pommy,
mm-hmm.
deserter from the British Army.
Right.
And
but a good gardener.
Well, he used to... you dig where you told him to dig. I think that's probably... And he and Mum got on very well, but he was a... great old fellow, and he's got a story. He'd go to town, he had a horse and sulky, go to town, and he drank a lot of grog, but when he went to town with his horse and sulky, drive up the main street, tie the horse under the shade, and then he decided he wanted to get on the grog. So he'd drive home and feed his horse, and then he'd walk back to town. Come home drunk about 2 days later. But he always made sure his horse was fed and watered and let go till he got home.
Oh, very considerate
Sid.
For the horse.
Oh, he's a funny old fellow. But he was a great old mate of Mum's. And then when he couldn't work, we had another old... I'd bought another block of country that had an old cottage on it. So we did that up and put furniture in there, and he lived there for the rest of his life in the old cottage. But he couldn't work or anything, and we used to get a taxi fellow that Forsyth,
mm-hmm.
who was a taxi cab man in Inverell for years and years, and once a week we organised that he, Dad would say, or it was probably me then at that age, come up and pick him up, take him to town, and then bring him back home again later on.
Sober or not?
So it went on, so walking all the way. With a flagon over your shoulder.
Can you paint me a bit of a word picture of what the garden was like in your mother's time?
Yes, I'd say there were always... The shrubs were well kept. The edges of the lawn was a great thing to cut around the edges of the lawn, so the edge of the lawns were always neat. There's no soldiers, as you call them. You've got to get over here and get rid of these soldiers, which are old grass running up to head, which made everything, it still does. So that basic things she did and could handle them. Keep the weeds off the old brick tennis court. In the early days, the old tennis court still had the tennis net around it. The old...
The brick one.
Yes. And that was pulled down, and that changed a bit, and the double garage was put in there, and the cars parked actually on one end of the tennis court. But I suppose she just toiled away at it, just kept it neat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was far from... I mean, if you had a full-time gardener, you had a water supply that was more than just a windmill supply. I mean, I think she would have... She had the ability, the courage and the tenacity to make a very smart garden.
And your sister was married in the garden, was that right?
Oh, test me. Yeah, she probably was.
I might have got that wrong.
Well,
I send her
our
a
daughters were married. Well, one that Jack was married in the garden, that's the extended garden, what we call the wedding garden even to this day. She was married there. That's the bit outside through the gate where it goes down there.
Now, that'd be much more recent, of course.
That was probably, that'd be 30-odd years ago. My other daughter, Susanna, was married in Sydney. So Jack was married here. And Tony's, she's older than I am. Not much, a couple of years older than I am. So she's 80, or 81.
And I guess you'd say two things that teenage boys aren't particularly interested in are weddings and gardens. So
that's very true.
Pretty hard question,
yeah,
isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, there's a lot of those things. I don't know whether I ever, I suppose I knew. A lot of things, excuse me, very clear to me of what happened. And they keep coming back. One thing leads to another and leads to another, but closer to the day, I'm not too flash.
We all have gaps but if I can take you back to when you came back here after school, you would have had sheep here as well at that time.
Mainly sheep, just sheep, virtually no cattle, but we had another place at Ashford. It was a weather place called Yambagunya, where we ran weathers. Rough trap rock country, but great weather country, and fine wool country. We used to run it from here, and there was a cottage on the place, and I kept a horse down there, so I could drive down, and I bought an F.J. Holden Ute, and so I could drive down there and stay a couple of nights and drench or whatever it is with my dogs. And at shearing time, as we progressed, we used to truck the sheep. We didn't have a shearing shed on the place. For a couple of years we shore on a neighbour's place, but that was the time used driving to the neighbour's place and back again. And I'm sure they didn't mind, but so I used to truck them with Campbell, truck them from Yambagunya to here, which is probably, wouldn't be 40 kilometres, but a pretty ordinary truck up through Bacala. And and we used to shear, you know, we shore quite a few sheep in those times, so the shearing was two shearers. Shearing went on long enough so we could backload, brought up some woolies, and then we'd send Shawnee's back.
Now that makes sense, because I was wondering why for 40 kilometres you didn't walk them and bring them all in one mob.
Well, then you'd have to look after them for right through the whole period here. And I did that with cattle, where I brought cattle up that I walked up. I used to walk them from Yambagunya to Bacala, and I put them in the Bacala station yards overnight, and then I'd walk them the rest of the home, which was two fairly good walks, even with cattle. But I wouldn't do it with sheep. There were too many hassles with dogs on the road. I used to still hate having my dog on the road, moving stock. We moved stock from here quite often, only cattle, from here to Byron Siding, which is almost a laneway all the way across, which is just over the hill there. So we do move cattle backwards and forwards quite a lot, but we do have to cross the main road. But of course, today it's all bikes.
It's alarming. We have to take cattle across the New England Highway, before John had the other part lease.
Yeah.
And we used to move sheep across there. Nearly all of them every shearing.
Yeah.
We'd have to come across to the homestead.
Yeah.
Wasn't the traffic that you get now, though.
No, well, you know, on the outskirts of Inverell, 8:30 till 9:30, you'd always need traffic lights. We'd have to have special signs up as we cross the stock, because they come onto the bitumen and they spook a bit, and if one runs away and the dog goes after them, the fellas fly late to work, and I'm always so relieved once they get across the bitumen, and once they cross, they just go straight into the other place. either Palaroo or Byron Siding.
But the river flats, like, would have always been cropped?
Yes, they were. We used to run sheep on them on Lucerne at one stage, but not a lot. I mean, the first crop that was grown on Byron was grown in 1852, and that's in Mrs. Ross's Reminiscences, the book that she wrote, and she recorded that.
That's Mrs. Ross from Balaclava.
Ross store, the main store in Inverell.
Yes.
That set up there, the Ross
family. They may be the same family. There was Colin Ross who set up the store in Inverell, and then he took up land at Matheson.
Balaclava.
Yeah. Same one?
Well, no, I better not comment on that. I'm not too sure. I'm not sure that it is. But it could be, but it was certainly Ross's store that set up on what was part of Byron in those days, and there were where Inverell is now. But the original township that was surveyed as a township is called the town of Byron, which is just down the river from here, and it was on Byron, and it's still there, still surveyed, and there are still blocks there.
Really? And it's part of Byron today?
No, it isn't. No, it's part of one of the other blocks. But so that's where the powers that be wanted the Inverell to be, town of Byron. Mm. And I mean, there would have been a lot of cottages and things around Byron Station at the time. But it didn't change. That's where the drays and everything came. They crossed the river and they camped on the river. And that's where Colin Ross set up his store. And that's, you know, one of the main suburbs, the high part of the town is called Ross Hill these days.
And the school,
Ross Hill School. But the other thing I didn't mention, talking about old Darby Heath, and he's describing the river and what they did on it. He said, because it was a magnificent place for fruit. He said people came from all over the south and one thing, and ate their fruit, threw the stones out. He said the fruit trees were just incredible on that flat, all over, as it was called, the Green Swamp in those days, and it was covered with these fruit trees. And he said, the magnificent fruit. And he said, of course, no fruit fly.
So that would be stone fruits, apples?
Yeah, anything that sort of grew, get away from the frost a bit, not on the river, but there are places very close to the river, just out of town. The hill that you'll see from the front of Byron here now that's called Fletcher's Seat. And I bought the top of that hill, and it's totally flat. You can see for miles from up there. And they used to grow stone fruits up on top of that hill, and they'd be out of the frost.
You would have had an orchard here on Byron in the early days?
Yes, of a sort, and you can see in one of the old photos where they've got a picket fence around it on the flat between the house and the river. After the war, we did, there were market gardeners, grew vegetables here on the flat, and there was a pump down there that they could irrigate with. Herb Morris and Arthur Newman were the two fellas that grew there. Herb Morris, the Morris family, have still got a fruit shop in Inverell.
Yes.
And I've got wonderful, when we were kids, memories of what they did down there. They farmed with an old horse. Can't remember her name, but an old mare that used to plug along. Anyway, like buying a new car, they bought a new horse.
What?
Baldy, I can remember Baldy very well. Anyway,
Draft horse,
to cultivate all the country where they sowed their carrots and cauliflowers and everything else they grew. Big start when they started Baldy off. They hitched him up and away Baldy went. Instead of slow step from the old mare, get up Baldy, and of course Baldy got up all right, and away he went, and I can still see Arthur Newman trying to pull him up, pull, and Dad yelled out to him, say something to him, Arthur, woo, and he stopped dead.
He was trained.
By then there was half an acre of cauliflower and, but they had an old, oh, I can't remember. I think it was probably an old Dodge Ute. They used to load up with boxes of stuff to take to the stores in town each day.
So would that be just for local or...?
Just local. Oh, yes, just local. Yeah.
Because I know in Glen Innes they had the freezing works for vegetables, but that's into the 50s and 60s, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, that's probably right, because they did have a freezing works in town. Mm. Bacon factory, too, they had in Inverell. And people invested in that. And I've still got an old share certificate that my grandfather bought shares in the bacon factory, which is in a book out there. So they did, but no, they were fresh, straight to town, straight into the store, and back out again, whatever it was they did.
Because it's obviously such wonderful country.
Oh, yes, it's down a great, all flat, those flats.
The garden would be basalt as well, of course.
Yes, but it's running into that lighter, stony country, and that's why the house is still standing, I suppose, because of the better foundation. I mean, it'd never be here. All those flats and the major floods that we've hit were covered by floodwater.
Yes.
Going all right back towards the Ashford Road as you drove in.
And it's incredible.
Only three times that's happened.
How they knew, you know, what the flood level would be when they built these old places, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I suppose you take levels. I mean, the original, where they settled originally on the flat, obviously that flooded. There's still a little bit of foundation stone, river gravel built up down there. So how things last. I mean, there was a jump, two jumps built there, horse jumps, that were put up there. And Dad said, well, they've got to stay there because the light horse had this big sports event once a year called the Prince of Wales Cup that all the troops from all around challenge for, and they had it here one year, and that the jumps that were put up and the competition in that, the funny stories involved.
So you're talking about a period between the First and Second World
Wars.
That's
right, sort of in the late 20s, early 30s, I suppose, and that's when they used to camp at have the camp at the Armidale Showground or the Glen Innes Showground or at Goswick, whatever. And the photos that I've got of them competing down there, horses galloping up. I think there were six in a whatever it is they call them, I've forgotten the term they use, six horsemen, and they all gallop up to a certain spot. Five of the horsemen dismounted with their guns. And the sixth fellow galloped off leading their horses, see? So he's got his own horse and five others to take them back out of gunshot range. And then when the shooting was over, you had to gallop back with leading the horses again, and the fellows that had been fighting had to jump back on the horses and then race back.
So it was obviously very important.
Oh, part of the
that
train.
They had their own horses too. The First World War they took their horses from here.
They did. And so they had their own horses. But Dad said he's never seen so many of these horses galloping around the flat in his life. Because full gallop, managing six horses, getting back there, fellas trying to get back on him. He said, of course, there were horses everywhere. They had to jump. Had to go for two jumps on the way down and two jumps on the way back.
Phenomenal.
Good story. Yeah. And one of the major cups they were competing for was called the Gunyawarrildi Cup, which was donated by the Mackay family that owned Gunyawarrildi at Warrialda at the time. Anyway, it's still on the mantelpiece in the billiard room down there. There have been times when I've intended to give it to someone, and the Mackay sisters were out here some Sunday lunch or something one day, and they knew it was here, and I said, well, what do you think I should do with it? She said, well, you've probably kept it safe for 60 years. Why don't you keep it a bit longer? So it's still there, but some of the other light horse stuff I did give to some enthusiastic people, but never got it back. So.
They have a light horse museum, do they not? Is it in Tamworth?
I think it is, yes. Mm. I think they do have it.
Because this was all a great area. I mean, the Cheval brothers from around Tenterfield Tablet.
Oh, yeah, it was. It was. Great stories.
Is there anything I haven't asked you about the garden?
Oh, the garden I've cut pretty short.
I'll get Christine about that later.